Buddy, this is Dave Douglas and A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. This is our 100th episode. It's amazing. I can't believe it. So when I started this podcast with Michael Bates on March 19th, 2013, I just wanted a space to have conversations with musicians about their music. I've learned so much, and it's broadened and widened the scope. It's really been a wonderful experience talking to so many people about their music, and it's ear-opening for sure. Thank you all for listening and for all your warm comments over these years. This podcast, as you know, has always been ad-free. It's a labor of love for sure, and I do hope that listeners will check out what's on offer at Greenleaf Music. Plenty of CDs, LPs, sheet music, also a membership model that lets you support our work on an ongoing basis. I plan to continue these conversations going forward, and we'll be letting you know of other ways to support the podcast, including supporting my faithful editor, Jeff Countryman, and everyone at Greenleaf who works to get this done and to get it into your ears. For this special episode, I ask Michael Friedman, my old friend and the co-founder of Greenleaf Music, to come and chat. He's an amazing guy, a drummer, composer, director of the Premonition label. And he convinced me to create Greenleaf Music in 2004 and held my hand through all the birth pangs and all the other complications. We talk a bit about starting the label, and mostly we decided to talk about recent recordings I've produced for Greenleaf. Mike quizzes me on some recent musical adventures, and I had a blast catching up with him. So here's your episode 100. Enjoy, and more to come. Join us at greenleafmusic.com for our membership and all our recordings. Thank you for your support, and thanks for listening. Thank you. Hey, Mike.
Dave, how you doing?
How you doing? I'm good. It's great to see you.
You look great. I got more gray hair than the last time you saw me, but...
I don't know if we've ever Zoomed before, actually. I've known you so long, I think that we sort of predate the Zoom era.
Oh, yeah, I think we predate the CD.
That's true.
Yeah, we predate a lot of stuff. Not as much as some people, but pretty good.
Well, thanks for doing this with me.
I'm happy to. Kidding?
100th episode of this podcast. And yeah, I actually, well, you know that I originally was going to invite you on to talk about when we started this label in 2004, 2005. And you were like, yeah, I'm not comfortable talking about all that stuff. So I said, well, let's talk about music.
Yeah, so. I would much prefer to talk about the music. I'll talk about the label founding and all that stuff because I think it's somewhat interesting, and what you're doing with Greenleaf is incredible. I always thought it was, but let's talk about the music more. That's better.
Okay, I'm down. I'm curious though. You said you wanted to talk about the music, and you picked that track "Convenings" from the Dream album, and I'm curious why you like. It's a deep cut.
I love this album. I love the instrumentation. Players are playing beautifully. Is this one of the ones that you had to record remotely or not?
It was one of the first ones that I had to record remotely, and it was a commission from Monash University that I think was initiated before the lockdown, and then. We all just decided, let's just go ahead and do it. You know, we'll figure it out. Yeah. And so it was the beginning of the remote recording phase. Yeah. And
I wanted to ask you later. I mean, I think it sounds great, but like there's a bunch of these recent records that are remotely recorded. Mm-hmm. Do you think you'll ever like record them in a real recording studio in the future? Or is this
I think they are... very much, you know, created to the moment and to the creative challenge of making music this way. Yeah. And I'm hoping to be back in a studio and having a whole new experience of that way of playing. Yeah. But I don't see this as any sort of compromise or like I'm going to go back and do it again. Like a lot of my projects, you know, these will be ongoing recording situations, and I made a double album with the quintet with John Arabigan, Matt Mitchell, Linda Mahano, and Rudy Royston. That's going to come out later in 2022.
Remotely?
That was completely remotely.
Holy shit!
And it's and the challenge of that one was that I said, okay, I'm going to write all these pieces, and then I'm going to record all my own parts first. So I played the heads in and the solos, and then gradually, one by one, went around to each player, and everyone was under lockdown. Linda was in Australia, and everyone recorded their parts, and it came out great. And I said, it became part of the creative inspiration and challenge to think differently about how we're going to create improvised music together. That piece, Convenings in particular, if I showed you the score, it's just a set of instructions for each individual player with very strict timing instructions. Uh-huh. So you do this for this amount of time and then do this. So each of the, I think it's 12, maybe more, maybe it's like 16 music. I can't remember right now off the top of my head, but each person recorded to these instructions in their own studio without hearing anyone else and sent all their files. And then we put them all together. And there was a take one where there were some things that worked and some things where people either weren't precise enough or my instruction wasn't clear enough, various things that I felt could be improved. So then I edited the score and we did a take two, and that's what's on the record.
It's crazy. I mean, I wondered if you had, if it was sort of mapped out in a certain way, because it seems like there's, more repetitive notes at a faster clip in the middle. But the reason I picked it, I love all the more thoroughly composed compositions, but this is all open. And oddly enough, I felt the band really coalesced. On this track, the whole thing sounds great. I'm blown away.
Well, it's interesting because on the other tracks, most of the musicians were playing to something that someone else had played. So there was the interactive, playing along to some, whereas in this one, each person really did record in isolation. And so when I was able to play them the mix of all the tracks that they had sent, it was just kind of electrifying to hear it come together to hear things where, people play the same thing and it's great. It's just beautiful.
Wow, man. So that's why I picked it. I just listened to the whole album, but on that one, I don't know. It just felt more like a band or something. I don't know what it was, but you know.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
That's a high compliment coming from you.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the music. If you want to talk about the beginning of Greenleaf, I think it's interesting, what you went through and what I went through. I was a musician. We first met when I was still playing, I was a, C-level drummer in Brooklyn, along with a bunch of other people. And there was a recording session of one of your ex-roommates. And, or was he your roommate at the time? I can't remember. Anyway, we all got together and the rising star, Dave Douglas, came in. And because you were musicians will relate to this. There's certain guys who are, the C-level guys. And by the way, the C-level guys I was playing with in Brooklyn were phenomenal musicians. And then there was Dave, who was a rising star even at that time. It's probably like mid-80s, right? It's 85 or something like that?
Something like that.
Anyway, yeah. You came in and I'll never forget it. I'll never forget it. It's like musicians will know when someone starts playing, the band is galvanized. People are playing better just for the fact that that one person is playing. And it was rhythmically, it was creatively. And you were just starting out too. So I'll never forget it. And I never did. That's why I always stayed in touch. We always stayed in touch throughout the years. I started a label myself. I quit playing drums because we won't go into all that, but I started a label and I got you on one of my sessions. We stayed in touch this whole time. And then, before you signed with RCA, I wanted to sign you. If you remember, we had a conversation and I wasn't able to do it, but and I think it worked out pretty well for you too, just in terms of that you're able to make all those great records. And where was I going with this? Why was I starting to talk? I got you on a couple of Premonition records, and then we signed a deal, Premonition, with Blue Note. We kind of went up the ladder there, and then in 2004, crashed down off the ladder. And at that time, you were done with RCA, right? At 2004?
Well, right. RCA got bought by Sony and everything changed. But also I had completed my contract. So it was time to renegotiate. But just everything got flipped on its head.
And, we everything was changing for us at the same time, too. We still had good things going on. So we had good distribution, and you were trying to figure out what you were going to do next. And we had many conversations, as I recall, about Greenleaf. And that's how it happened.
You were instrumental in, talking me into doing this, because I was leaving the major label world. And I had been in the independent label world for quite a number of years before that. And so it was like, do I want to go back to doing that, or do I want to step into a new thing? And it just felt like the time, and this was before the internet really took over things. It just felt like, okay, it's time to take responsibility for all my work on my own. Not have a boss and not have to go to the 52nd floor of a building in Times Square to explain to someone what I wanted to do. But, you know, it was inspiring because you were already doing it.
Yep.
And I had friends that were doing it. John Zorn, you know, I was touring with him and he'd been running Tzadik for a good number of years, and Tim Byrne with Screw Gun. And of course, you know, the historic examples of people like Max Roach and
Betty Carter,
Charles Mingus and Betty Carter and Horace Silver. And so it was just something that I saw as a good creative challenge and solution to the issue of how I wanted to handle that moment.
Right.
And then everything changed so much in the few years after we started it. So,
but the key to the whole thing, I thought, because I was steeped in retail, because that was my, you know, that was what was, I started in 93, the label, which we could talk about that too, but no, we don't want to talk about that. But, you know, it was just a whole different era of the music business. But that was my grounding, and that's what I knew. And that's what I was doing, but that you had the idea for the subscriber portion of it, which I thought was fantastic. And there are these people that love that love the music and want to be a part of it. And how do we find them outside of the bounds of the regular retail business? And how do we, keep them inspired? And I just thought it was fantastic. And we set that all up, and then we got a cease and desist letter. I remember that. Remember that? Some guy who shall remain nameless thought we were infringing on his intellectual
property. We were basically stealing his idea. Yeah.
Which was crazy because there was nothing like that at the time. And almost even now.
That was a scary moment, and thank you for holding my hand through that, Mike. To me, it just meant, oh, here's an idea that is now taking shape. And, you know, we weren't the only ones to be thinking of this in that moment. And also the way that we were envisioning it, doing it, was very different than this person who asked us to stop because he felt we were copying his idea, and we had a different model, as does everyone. And if anything, in the years since the internet took over, the models for doing this are even more individual.
Yeah.
Among different artists having Bandcamp pages or SoundCloud pages or their own imprints, where they release their own music and also music of their peers and people that they want to support. So that was interesting.
I think we got a letter from, we talked to an attorney and he said, ignore the guy. And we did. And that was the end of it, I think, is what ended up happening. Let's listen to another one. I liked, I love the Overcome record is also remotely recorded.
Yes.
Right. So you want to listen to, I like that tune, Overcome.
Okay.
Should I play it?
Let's hear some.
Just say I'm ransom overcome makes me feel alive. With your voice I'm overcome makes me feel alive.
That was Camille, right?
The first vocalist is Camilla Meza.
Yeah.
And then the second one is Faye Victor.
Yeah. They both sound so beautiful on this record. I've heard both of them. Actually, I heard Camilla with Ryan's band, and I heard Faye did this thing at Elastic Arts, it's an arts venue here in Chicago. I don't know if you've ever played there, but it's a, you know, Ken Vandermark's kind of involved and Dave Rempus, and they do a lot of free stuff. And she did a whole night, fully improvised, and it was just Faye was just mesmerizing.
Yeah.
So,
She is amazing, and everything I hear her do is just beautiful. It's great.
Yeah,
and very versatile. She was on the podcast once, and
I know.
I learned a lot from talking to her.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is, you haven't done much with singers. It's weird. Your career is interesting. I mean, I've always liked that you did, always loved the Terms of the Night Sky sort of strain of what you do. The quintet, probably my main focus, generally speaking. Where would this fall in to your?
It's for me. It's kind of, well.
It's not that.
It's kind of a new zone. However, I mean, I think it's definitely. I don't want to say a protest album, but an activism encouragement album.
Yeah.
Like marching music, or like Witness, or some of the other things that I've written that are very specifically about social
strange liberation
events and strange liberation and movement. And so this one, I mean, the band came about because Ryan Keberly and I wanted to do some music explicitly to get out young voters in the 2020 election in November 2020. And so it began as, we're going to write this music that's movement oriented and that will hopefully tour in the Midwest, and we'll go to colleges and play for young people and talk to them and try to encourage people to get out and be involved and vote. And then, of course, everything shut down. And I started writing, and I just was like, okay, we may not be able to do this tour in the fall, but we can't stop the music. Right. And I had already begun an arrangement of We Shall Overcome, inspired by the movement, by being out in the street, but also by Carla Bley's arrangement from the Charlie Hayden Liberation Music Orchestra, 1968. Yeah. And it's just, I started writing and kept writing. And originally we were only going to have one singer. And then when I realized we were going to be creating it in isolation, I said, well, I can't decide whether to call Camila Meza or Faye Victor, so why not have them both? So that's the way we did it. And I got some support from a guy in Palo Alto named Mark Weiss. He's got a organization called Lions with Wings, and he just supports creative musicians around the country. And so he loved the idea, and we figured at some point we'd go to Palo Alto. That still hasn't happened because, you know, things are still a little up in the air. But that was how the record got started. And so I'd say that it also collides with my feeling about song and folk music is a terrible, terrible word. Popular music, let's call it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Music and so, mm-hmm. Well, you know, like when my mom asked me to do those hymns for her in 2011, and that became the album Be Still. And there was some originals and arrangements of hymns, and then the band went on to play some spirituals and just get involved in older American music. Like on the duo that I recorded with Uri Kane, where we played Sacred Harp songs, that's called Present Joys. You know, those are things deeply embedded in how I feel about the music, and they'll, you know, they seem to come out on various projects. So it's interesting that you're seeing that my work in terms of all these different strains, and you know, because this Overcome band was a new band, I always feel like when it's a new group of personalities, there has to be a different logic and strategy to the writing.
Yeah.
And so it's, well, something anomalous, something different.
Yeah. I mean, the Be Still, which is just, I'm sure people know, is just a great record, but also the sound of that record is beautiful, I think. You know?
Well, and that's Joe Furla, one of the last records I did with Joe Furla. Yeah. And it's Aoife O'Donovan singing.
Yeah.
Aoife O'Donovan. Quite importantly.
But just as an aside, I find it interesting that you have an incredible, Joe Furla was an incredible technical person on your side, but then these guys you have now, the way they're mixing these records that are coming from all these different places.
Well, I've learned a lot of Pro Tools myself the last couple of years.
So you do like the EQs and the reverbs and all that stuff?
Not for the final mixes. No. I don't have that kind of gear, but I can assemble things and of course I'm recording myself and receiving everybody's files and, you know, in general putting things together. But yeah, Tyler McDiarmid and Jeff Countryman are the two engineers that I primarily work with. And of course they're also doing a lot of remote now as well, so we're able to share files back and forth and in various formats and work on things that way.
Well, just a quick thing, so does everybody record flat, like nothing, and then it's added in the mix? I mean, how do you approach doing it?
I try to get just as clean a signal as we can get from the players. On this new record that's coming out, Secular Psalms, Lander Gieselink is the drummer, and he sent us about 10 tracks of drums, so each individual. And I mean, that was and completely clean, no reverb, just straight signal. Cool. And it was a lot of work, but it was great to have all that. Now with Rudy, he's done a lot of recording himself. So he's got, I don't know how many mics he has, but he blends it all down to a stereo image of the drums. So on Overcome, what we received was just a stereo blast of drums, and they were really beautifully balanced and sounded great and spatially perfect. So, and I think that you know, that speaks to Rudy as a player, but also that he's able to give us what he really wants his kit to sound like, which is what I want as a composer, band leader. So everybody's a little bit different. Often with bass players, I try to get two different signals. One from a direct a DI and one from a microphone, and usually a blend of those will sound really natural.
Yeah. Well,
and then I bought an AEA R84 ribbon mic about a month into lockdown. And I swear by it. I love it. It's a great sounding microphone.
Is that the one that Joe would use on you? Anyway, let's not get into all this stuff. But
it's an interesting question, and the answer is kind of yes, because the R84 is a remake of the RCA 44 microphones, those old ribbon microphones that Joe always used on me and that I love.
Yeah. So, all right. By the way, the drums on Monash, to go back, those sound unbelievable. Oh, I'm going backwards, but I'm a drummer. I'm an ex-drummer, so. This record just kills me.
Thanks. Sim Kane, the drummer?
I don't know any of these people.
So marching music, and it's Rafik Bhatia on guitar, Melvin Gibbs on bass, legendary player, Sim Kane, legendary drummer. They were the rhythm section for the Rollins band, Henry Rollins.
Jeez. What gets me is, I mean, the first thing that hits me is your tunes, of course, but the blend. I mean, it's like the guitar player can go from like some kind of, it almost sounds like, you know, metal, I don't know what, you know, high distortion, overdrive, metal sound. And then it sort of meanders into something that could sound like almost like an R&B track, you know, or R&B set of changes. Mm-hmm. And I just love it. I think it's super interesting, and the playing is great.
Rafik is an amazing player, and his own records are extraordinary sonically. Like
sonically, yeah, I mean, he's
even beyond what's happening on here. But
yeah,
you know, he plays some incredible solos on here that, if I didn't know better, I would call them jazz guitar. He plays with a band called Sun Lux, which is a really happening sort of indie creative rock band.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, I think it's just, I just love the way it's your tunes. I mean, this is probably in the strand of music from, not Witness, but maybe Freak In into the high risk stuff that you did, or that kind of
maybe.
Stuff, would you say? Or
yeah, maybe. Yeah. I mean, this is a band that I had high hopes to get out on the road. And, you know, we recorded this a few months before lockdown in a studio. And then we just, you know, we played one gig before the recording session. And then we just, and, you know, everybody's busy. Everybody does a million other things. But I wrote and recorded the music because I was going to a lot of marches and climate strikes and, you know, movement things. And I'm not comfortable in a big crowd of people where thousands of people are shouting the same thing. Even if I'm on their side and I agree, I'm not a joiner in that way. It just feels like, you
Me
know,
neither.
I mean, yeah. I'm behind the sentiment and I want to be there, but I have trouble shouting slogans. So I thought, okay, well, what would the music be that I would want to have on blasting in my headphones at one of these marches so I could be there and just sort of be in this space with the sound that I want to have happening and not the chanting. And so that's what all these songs are meant to
yeah,
represent.
That climate strike is a killer. That's a killer track too. Oh man.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah.
I mean, I just, it's just blown away by how the breadth of it, you know, the musicianship and the way you pull it all together, you know, I mean, it's, I think you're taking risks, you know, I like that too. You know, it's maybe less predictable or something.
Again, thank you. It is taking risks, but it's taking risks in the sense of when you decide to do something, just really going all in, committing to it. And like I said earlier, when you're playing with new musicians, you have to adapt and change and write something for them. I mean, Melvin Gibbs, I've been listening to him for years and I just love his sound, and I had never played with him. Just reached out and he was into it. And we had a bunch of conversations about the goals and about what the music should be. And I have to say, just listening to him talk about the music was a big influence on how I ended up writing it. And so then, you know, the risk is that I then try to write this thing and I've just completely missed.
Right.
It can happen, but I sort of feel like you have to try to write things that you never wrote before and write in new ways that you never thought about before. And to be honest, you know, I have people, young musicians that I work with at the New School who inspire me in that way, where, you know, we're talking about creating music and they come at it from a completely different place. And I speak from experience about some observations and some ways of working that can be interesting. And then they come up with completely different things sometimes that I'm uncomfortable with, but I would never shut anybody down. But also just, you know, looking at it from a completely different angle. And I would like to feel like one can continue to work that way over a number of years.
Yeah. So on Dizzy Atmosphere, you've got the young trumpet player. Was he be someone that?
Yeah.
You'd be talking.
David Adewumi, who I met in a seminar at Juilliard. Young player from New Hampshire, from a Nigerian family, I don't like the word composition because so many people use it with a sense of ownership and entitlement. So creating music is what I like to, there's nothing there. There is silence. And now I'm creating music. Whatever that is. So anyway, well, I gave them a series of prompts to work with, and he came in with this piece that was really inspiring and beautiful. And I just sort of got to know him and we hit it off. And, he's just playing all over the place and just sounds beautiful, but also very creative. And when I was going to make this tribute to Dizzy Gillespie, I knew that I wanted to have another trumpet player in the band. So I felt like this was a great, the same way that Dizzy brought Lee Morgan into his band when they did that great concert at Newport, I felt like, okay, let me do this thing and bring in Adewumi and
John
have him
Faddis
play.
Too, right? I mean, he brought in John Faddis later.
Yeah. And I think so. Adewumi was very, I don't want to say deferential, but, very sort of respect, honoring the situation that we were in together playing and trying to, bring his own voice into the project, but also in a way that was going to fulfill my vision as a composer. And, that's just amazing for someone to have that awareness and approach. So I'll always appreciate that. I want to say he's probably now 25, maybe.
Thank you.
Oh my God. The reason I, so it's, you know, it's such a specific thing, but I, first of all, that was one of the first records I ever bought, was that, was the original version of that, you know, oh. I had Miles Smiles, I had, Dear John C, and I had Swing Low Sweet Cadillac. And, but, and then I heard him play it. I heard him play it several times, once where it was more restrained and once where it was just crazy.
With James Moody and
the whole... No, I never heard it with James Moody, but actually that is another connection for me, because probably the highlight of my playing career is I played a weekend with James Moody at the Jazz Showcase in Chicago.
Wow.
And yeah, it was just unbelievable. I was young, but you know, and he was just this magnanimous person. And of course, amazing musician, but that, and that tune is, you know, it's an entertainment tune, obviously. And, but it got me thinking about Dizzy, and it got me sort of nostalgic, because I remember how good it made me feel to hear them do that tune, and how, because of what, well, his personality and his stage presence and his vibe, you know, was entertainment oriented, I guess. Of course, they would put down the entertainment and then play some shit you couldn't believe every set, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think about like that young guy, because I just wonder where all that's gone. That doesn't seem to be part of the landscape anymore, and I feel like it made me nostalgic for it, and you know,
you mean the sense of humor and playfulness, yeah. And
you talk about how these younger people have a whole other view on things. Well, that could never be part of their view, because it seems to me anyway. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but it's not in the world anymore. Those guys are gone. I mean, and I think that's a drag, you know. So it makes me feel. Not that this tune is the greatest tune ever written or whatever, the height of jazz music, or even Dizzy, I don't even think he would say that, but there's something about it that I miss, you know? So,
yeah.
I don't know what to say. That's why I picked it, because it just...
I just love the performance, but I hear you. That's really interesting. I mean, having done... homages to Lester Bowie, I feel like the comedic show element that he permitted us all to go for already existed for me. And if anything, Dizzy was an earlier exponent of having levity in the music, you know, not making the music so deadly serious that there can't be moments of levity and joy and laughter. And I think that's something universal in music, that the music that we love and hear, we like to hear that sense of playfulness. I feel like that the down-to-earth quality of it is really important.
Yeah.
And I think even somebody like Miles Davis... You know, there's an aura of high art in everything he did, but there's also an aura of people's music, you know, being close to the ground and you know, singing a song and delivering it. And that's, I think, the ultimate mystique of him, is to be able to feel all of that at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's what you get with Dizzy.
I don't know where
too.
This is going necessarily. It's not really part of the current vibe, or at least I don't feel it. So in the same way, maybe that means just I'm old, but the thing that really got me into jazz was hearing Elvin Jones, you know, and I was 14 years old, talk about myself a little bit, but you know, it was the groove. It was the infectiousness.
Yeah.
It was the,
right.
It was all, it was all that. Of course, in the midst of playing some of the most complex drumming ever made, you know? So anyway, I just, that's why I picked that song.
But Elvin Jones, he's a really good example of what I'm trying to talk about.
Yeah,
of,
absolutely.
I mean, it's profound, but it's also, you know, something very, I want to say as a metaphor, low to the ground, you know, it's a groove. And I talk about that with Joey Barron a lot. You know, how do you convey that? Because Joey's playing for me always has that sense of joy and bounciness and fun and just groove. And, you know, Joey can also do some very sophisticated rhythmic ideas, but at the root of it, it's like moment to moment, beat to beat. How does it feel?
Well, there's a moment in that track, Cadillac, where Joey just plays. It's like a two-bar thing in the middle where it goes into the blowing thing. You know, it's like astonishingly perfect and beautiful. So, yeah, and grooving, you know. So, anyway, I don't know.
I appreciate that you picked that one. It's a slow build. It's a long build, Cadillac, my piece. And it's sort of a abstract, imagistic remaking of the performance with James Moody. And, you know, different instruments and different conversation, but still vibing off Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, which he renamed Swing Low, Sweet Cadillac.
And this is another strand, I mean, which I've always loved about your playing and your music and your you know, the records you make, is that you have this strand of doing these Mary Lou Williams and Wayne Shorter and, you know, and this. I think that brings joy to me. I like that you do that. And it comes out in your playing, whatever you're playing, that you're aware of. You don't hear a lot of people doing that. Let's put it that way. I mean,
I think that there is a fear of imitating, and I think that's too bad, because you're always going to sound like yourself. And I think it's important to shout out about the people who've been big inspirations in your life. You know, making an album for Mary Lou Williams, I think it's obvious my goal wasn't to just make music that sounds like her music, but it was rather to take the spirit that I heard in her playing and put it in my own words in today's language. And what is that record was about 99, 2000. And I just was like, what is it that I love so much about Mary Lou Williams? And what would I want somebody to hear and go, oh, I'm going to go check out Mary Lou Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the composition students, creating music workshop students, I give them prompts and assignments, and one of them comes from Mary Oliver's book, A Poetry Handbook. And she has a chapter called Imitation, where she talks about trying to write something that imitates something that already exists that you love. And not to worry about being accused of being an imitator, but just to, like, in your own musical imagination, you know, create something that reflects something that you really love. And it's a very challenging prompt. It's really hard. Some people really resist it. But I think it's a really good challenge to acknowledge how much you love something and how much it means to you, and to B, then reflect on it in your own terms and comment within the art form with your own music.
Yeah, I mean, I've always felt these records were stronger because you didn't just imitate them or just duplicate them, you know, that you...
Well, you know, I have been fortunate enough to be around Wayne Shorter, and who heard the record that I made in 96, but also, you know, wrote music for me and Joe with our band Soundprints that's dedicated to him. And he always said to us, you know, you guys don't play my music, play your music.
Yeah.
And then when he wrote us those pieces, he said, you don't have to play it the way I wrote it. You can completely do it your own way. And he, very slyly, he said, you know, no one's ever heard these tunes, so you could play whatever you want.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great part of what you do. I mean,
thank you.
I mean, you know.
God, I feel like I'm really getting the...
Well, you're getting the star treatment because you're the star, you know, and I'm...
Thanks. You know, it's so funny because here we are on Zoom and I'm listening to that and I realized, oh, I was right here when I played that. Exactly where all of that was played.
That one particularly has a great sonics, I would say. You know what I mean?
Oh, thank you.
Tomika sounds beautiful.
Tomika plays great, and it's me and Berlind Demann singing. And she plays tuba and serpent on a lot of the record.
Yeah, actually, I would make one comment. I think the mix was a little low on the male vocal.
Yeah.
Could have been a little.
I think that was intentional.
No, but the playing is. So this was a commission, right?
It was a commission to celebrate the 600th anniversary of this painting that I very much love in the city of Ghent. And so there was a lot of historical digging involved, and all of the texts come from, you know, various inspirations or actual authors from that period. And a lot of the musical language was inspired by the composers of that period, and also the sonics. Frederic Leroux plays electric guitar, but also plays lute. On a good number of the pieces, and then Tomika cello, and then there's Serpent, which is a sort of a middle age lower brass instrument made of wood that's very beautiful and often very sort of let's say, I was going to say microtonal, but I think a better word would be non-well-tempered. And then also Marta Varelli's Polish musician, wonderful, wonderful player. And she played piano and also pump organ. And so in the painting, there are several images of musicians playing. And in one of them, there's a young woman playing one of those organ portatif, old church organs. And so we got something very similar to that for the project.
Was this an idea that you had to write music inspired by this painting?
This was part of the commission that the city was celebrating the 600th anniversary. And so they wanted to also invite in other art forms to celebrate the work. Yeah. So it was a great honor. And of course, you know, the schedule of the thing, it took 2 years longer than it was supposed to. And, you know, I'm very grateful that my sponsor from Ghent didn't back out. And it made me want to just keep working, even though it just took months and months and months to get this written and made and recorded and mixed and mastered. And then, so the original premiere, it was supposed to be in November 2020. And we finally did it in November 2021. We did four festivals of playing this music live. And some of us had never met in person, but we'd already made the record. So, and you asked that question earlier, you know, do I go back and re-record this now? I don't think so. I mean, it's an ensemble that I love. And if I was going to go back and write something, I would write something new, something different. And maybe there's a theme of picking paintings from the early 1400s and diving into the painter's life and what they're about and what was in the cultural air at that time.
Is this, I mean, there's been some more, I don't want to say religiosity to some of your later stuff. Is this in that theme or is that...
There's a lot of spiritual stuff in this one for me. Mm-hmm. And some of that came out of the lockdown too, you know, finding meaning in all of this and finding uplift within all the uncertainty and the unknowing and finding a connection. I mean, by birth, I'm Christian and I've read widely from different religions, and yet I feel like there's something in Christianity that's there too, that is there for me, despite my involvement in so many other faiths. And just in the same way that Be Still brought me back into thinking about that, you know, this piece did too. It's very religiously motivated painting. And yet the artist's viewpoint, this is Jan van Eyck and to some extent his brother Hubert, they included all kinds of people in this painting. Like people from all walks of life, and rich people, poor people, pilgrims, hermits, warriors, judges, priests, angels. Of course, all the main figures of Christianity are in there, but it's interesting that it's the whole world. And so I called it Secular Psalms, thinking, you know, Psalms being songs of praise for all of us. Non-exclusive. An interesting fact about the painting is that it was quote-unquote restored in 1550. And when they did the restoration, they overpainted a lot of the images to sort of change the philosophical meaning. And if you think about it, you know, okay, it's originally painted in 1420. They started it, they finished it around 1430. And then in 1550, 20 years after the Reformation, Martin Luther, they had to change it because the meaning of all those figures changed for them. So they, and this was only discovered in the last 10 years when they went to make a new renovation and they discovered that the figures had been overpainted, including the lamb, which is the main character. And so they were able to remove that layer of paint and bring it back to what it originally looked like. And it's very humanistic and very real world. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I played there for a weekend and like a moron, I didn't get over there and look. And get, you know, so, I mean, I think I was just really tired and I was working too hard, but man,
yeah.
Huge mistake.
That's a beautiful, beautiful city, beautiful town. And, and it's, and now that the piece has been fully restored and it's back in place, you can actually go see it.
Yeah.
And it's worth seeing.
Oh, it wasn't open before then?
It had been open, but then when they went to restore it, they had to, you know, take it to the places where it could be worked on. And the work took longer than expected. And then the lockdown happened. So there was a big exhibition of Van Eyck that was supposed to happen in 2020 that they ended up doing a really wonderful virtual tour of it that was really informative and inspiring. But, you know, now things are starting to open again and it's actually on display.
Well, that's a great message to give to us all, man. I mean, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for listening to me blather on and on about these things. And it's great to see you. Great to talk with you. And thanks for joining me for the 100th episode.
Great, man. Well, I'll skip this one when I'm on my Peloton, but, you know.
Say hi to Joe Biden.
Okay. Right. Okay, man. Well,
awesome.
Thanks, man. Take it easy.
Thank you. To the end of another Greenleaf Music podcast, A Noise from the Deep with Dave Douglas. And I'm Dave Douglas. Thank you so much for checking it out. Hope you enjoyed it. And as I mentioned at the beginning, come and support Greenleaf Music by becoming a member or getting any of the CDs or LPs or sheet music that we supply and we make with love and hard work. And we appreciate your support so much. So thank you for listening. And until the next time.